For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Welcome to Ancient Dragon Zengate. For those of you who are here for the first time, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here, and I'm very happy and honored to welcome Zenshin Florence Kaplow, old friend, to Ancient Dragon Zengate to talk about her wonderful book, edited by her and another old friend, Sue Moon, The Hidden Lamp. So Florence and I practiced together at Green Gulch Farm years ago when she was very young. And also she sat with my former group in California before I relocated, before I escaped to Chicago at Mountain Source Sangha in Bolinas. And she's put together this wonderful book, The Hidden Lamp. So there are quite a few books, women's studies in both academic and amongst practitioners of Buddhism is an important topic, but this is really an exceptional book amongst the books that have come out in terms of presenting many, many, many stories from India, China, Japan, and the West as well, and wonderful commentaries by modern women teachers and practitioners really showing how we're living in an age of wonderful, wonderful women teachers. So thank you very much, Florence, for doing this book and for coming here. And so, please.
Good morning. Great to see you all. Well, first of all, I want to thank Taigen for inviting me. He invited both Sue and me, but I'm afraid Sue did not want to come to the Midwest. But she and I have been traveling around for the last few months sharing this book around the country. And it's been quite an extraordinary experience to see it come alive in other people's faces and lives and practice paths. And as Taigen says, we've been practicing together and talking together for a long, long time. I think we figured out it was 1993 that we were first together at Green Gulch. So it's wonderful to be here and be able to share with this Sangha a little bit of the wisdom of women from this book. This afternoon, there's going to be a discussion and a little more exploration of how did this book come into existence and how was it created and what are the questions around gender and Buddhism. But this morning, because it's traditional, in a Dharma talk, to really be focused on the teachings here. That's where the focus is going to be this morning. So if you want to come back this afternoon, it's at 1:30?
1:30, yeah. 1:30 more, to more 3. Informal. Yeah,
more informal. Please, you are very welcome. So, as I have been in the Midwest, I arrived on about March 27th to Indianapolis, and it was the dead of winter. There was not one sign of springtime, not one green shoot or bud on a tree that I could see on March 27th. I don't know about you here, but I know that in Indianapolis, there was nothing. And then the first weekend of April, I went up to Minneapolis to do some book events, and there was a foot of snow the first night I was there. I thought I had planned this whole thing out so that I would be gradually moving farther north and east later in the spring, and so I was a little shocked that apparently I hadn't quite understood the nature of things in the upper Midwest. And so there was a foot of snow the first day, and then by 2 days after I arrived, spring had arrived in Minneapolis. It was the most extraordinary thing. It was 60 degrees, and the birds were singing, and the flowers were beginning to appear. And just in the last week, this miraculous thing has happened. I don't know if you've noticed, but this... and you know, I was actually at a Unitarian church last Sunday, and a little boy went up, but they do a kind of joys and sorrows thing where people can go up and light a candle for a joy or a sorrow or concern. The little boy went up, and he said, I have been very worried that winter was not going to end. And I am so happy that it's springtime. And he lit a candle for spring. So I've been thinking a lot about spring and about flowers. So my talk today is about flowers. And I'm going to be turning flowers over the course of this talk. So I know as I arrived in Chicago last night, I could see all the kind of drifts of crocuses in people's yards, purple crocuses everywhere. And there was something quite poignant for me about this. My longtime livelihood and vocation has been as a field biologist, and specifically as a botanist, working all over the West, doing surveys for endangered plants. And usually, at just about this time of year, I'm headed out into the field, because in the West, also at this time of year, the flowers have begun to bloom, and that means it's time for me to return to my work. And instead, I find myself nurturing other kinds of flowers, bringing this book, which Sue and I midwifed for 4 years, into the world. So there's a kind of poignancy for me this spring, but also a joy that there's a different kind of flowering happening in my life this spring. And this time of year is the time of year in the Zen tradition where we celebrate Buddha's birthday. Do you do a Buddha's birthday?
Yeah, you know, we kind of missed it this year because we had so many other things going on.
Because it was still winter.
Yeah, so we didn't formally have our Buddha's birthday. This is our Buddha's birthday celebration.
Oh, good. Okay, so well, we'll celebrate Buddha's birthday.
We'll celebrate your birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you. So this is the time in the Zen tradition that Buddha's birthday is celebrated, and some of you who have been here in previous years may have experienced a Buddha's birthday celebration. And in that ritual, there's often a statue of a little baby Buddha, and he's usually decked in flowers. Sometimes there's actually whole pagodas covered in fresh flowers over the baby Buddha, and each person bathes the baby Buddha in sweet tea. It's a really beautiful ceremony. And so I was thinking about how... I've been thinking about flowers and the role of flowers in Buddhism and in the Dharma. And so we have these images of flowers from the time of the Buddha's birth, but we also have flowers from the moment of Buddha's enlightenment. So if you've ever heard the story of Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, as he awakens, the gods in the heavens realize what has happened, and they're filled with joy, and flowers rain down out of the sky onto the Buddha. And this is this image of the flowers raining down in joy at the awakening of a being we see over and over again in Buddhist literature. And I was also thinking about how in Japan right now, this is the time of the cherry blossoms. And for those of you who've been there, if you've seen images, you know that there are areas in Japan planted with hundreds, thousands of cherry trees. And they all bloom within a very short period of time. And the whole country goes crazy. I mean, basically, everybody goes out to picnic and walk and sit under the cherry trees while they're blossoming. I mean, wouldn't that be great if that was our great American holiday to celebrate the flowers as they've appeared? And then, of course, within a week or two, all the cherry blossoms begin to fall. And there are actually gatherings in certain places to celebrate the falling of the cherry blossoms, like it's a snowfall that's raining down onto the people down below, a sort of blizzard of cherry blossoms. So flowers are very interesting as I was going to say a metaphor, but I don't like that so much. I would just say flowers are very interesting in and of themselves. If you think about what we remember about spring, what's important about spring, it's the way, at least for me, that the grass turns green and the flowers appear. And it's in this reappearing of flowers is this sense of something new arising, something fresh, something alive, after a long time of darkness and cold and difficulty through the winter. And yet there's this other side of flowers that is expressed in the falling of the cherry blossoms in Japan, which is that flowers last for a very short time. So there's this moment where we have a beautiful bouquet and we offer it on the altar, and then a few days later, it begins to fall apart. And there are flower petals on the altar, and then if you leave that flower offering there too long, it becomes a meditation on the way everything decays. So flowers have this deep quality of poignancy, so beauty and impermanence together. And when I began to think about this, I obviously for me as a botanist, flowers are have been kind of at the center of my life for most of my adult life. And the way that you identify most plants is through the details, the very subtle details of the flower of that plant. Leaves matter too, to some degree, other things, but really, it's the nature of that flower, really looking closely at that flower. But Buddhism is also filled with these flower images. So there's the baby Buddha, there's the Buddha's enlightenment, but there is also the flower at the beginning of the story of Zen. For those of you who haven't heard this story, I think this is probably fairly mythological, but here's the story anyway that we Zen people tell. That the Buddha was sat down to give his Dharma talk one day. And all the monks were gathered in front of him, and lay people and lay women and nuns. And that day, instead of speaking, he held up a single flower. And out of the entire assembly, one person smiled. And that was Mahakashapa. And Mahakashapa is considered our first ancestor because something was transmitted, some understanding, some mutual seeing of the nature of things was transmitted between the Buddha and Mahakashapa at that moment that was beyond words. And that's at the heart of Zen practice and teaching. Not that we ignore words, but we know that the nature of things is always larger than any words we might use. And so I love that, in a sense, the Zen lineage appears at the moment that the Buddha holds up a flower. And this image goes on. Sometimes the Zen school is referred to as a flower. The five petals of Zen, referring to the five schools of Zen in China. So as if it's this continual opening into the world and gift to the world, this flower that's always changing, actually. This is a teaching from Bodhidharma, attributed to Bodhidharma. Who knows who actually said it? I originally came to this land of China to pass on the teachings of reality and to liberate people. He was the first Zen ancestor in China. Five petals opening, a single flower, fruit ripens by itself. So there's also this connection to fruit, to what nourishes us, to what feeds us. So in some ways, this is all an introduction to a story from The Hidden Lamp. And it's funny, I think that there is an association also between women and flowers. Women, sometimes in Western literature, have been referred to as flowers. And so I feel like there's a kind of affinity, and there are actually a number of stories in the book where flowers are prominent. But I also think that it's so much part of the Buddhist tradition that it's both together. So this is a beautiful story from the 13th century in Japan during the Kamakura period. And just to give you a little background, it takes place at a very, very unusual nunnery called Tokeiji. And Tokeiji was a Rinzai Zen nunnery. It was a place where many daughters of the imperial family ended up becoming nuns and practicing. So it was an imperial convent. But it had one extraordinary quality. For 600 years, no man entered the precincts of this temple. And in Japan, there was no way for a woman to separate from her husband, including in cases where the relationship was extremely violent. There was nothing a woman could do. Except if she could get to the gates of Tokeiji and inside the gate of Tokeiji and stay for a year, she was divorced. She was free from that relationship. And over the centuries, thousands of women were able to do this at Tokeiji. And there are wonderful stories, many wonderful stories of the women who practiced at Tokeiji. Another story from Tokeiji, this is true, this was actually what was there. There was a huge mirror in the meditation hall, and the nuns practiced zazen in front of the mirror. And I have never heard of this within any other Zen tradition, and there's something about women looking into the mirror and asking, who is this in the mirror as their practice, that I think is tremendously powerful. So, anyway, Tokeiji, the stories from Tokeiji are quite extraordinary. And this one is called The Flower Hall on Buddha's Birthday. And it's from the 13th century. So this is early in the, shortly after the founding of Tokeji. The nuns of Tokeji were famous for their beautiful and elaborate flower decorations on Buddha's birthday. So you could just imagine pagodas and decorations in the hall and flowers everywhere. At this right at this time of the year when all the cherry blossoms are blooming and the plum blossoms are blooming. Master Yodo, the abbess of Tokeji and a former imperial princess, wrote a verse on this occasion. Decorate the heart of the beholder, for the Buddha of the flower hall is nowhere else. I'll read that again. Decorate the heart of the beholder, for the Buddha of the flower hall is nowhere else. Her attendants also wrote verses. Ika, a former court lady, wrote, "Throw away into the street the years of the past. What is born now on the flower dais, let it raise its newborn cry." So those were two of the poems that were written in honor of Buddha's birthday. I'm sure there were hundreds of others over the centuries. And the structure of the book, for those of you who may not have seen it, is that there are 100 stories, 100 koans about women from the whole history of Buddhism, and then each one has a reflection. In the traditional koan collections, it would have been called a commentary, but we chose to call them reflections. Sort of one person's view from a different woman Buddhist teacher. And these teachers are from many traditions and actually across many countries. And in this case, this teacher is Australian. Her name's Amala Wrightson, and she was a student of Philip Catlow. And this is what she wrote. Or I'll read part of it. I won't read the whole thing. "A quick glance at these verses, and you might dismiss them as merely picturesque, aristocratic ladies writing elegant verses about their flower arranging and devotion in honor of the baby Buddha. How quaint and feminine. But look a little more closely, and you'll find direct and powerful teachings about the great matter of birth and death. Whether you are at a Chinese, Korean, Japanese, or American Zen temple, the central ritual of the Buddha's birthday celebrations is the same. A small sculpture of the infant Buddha, one hand pointing skyward and the other to the earth, is decorated with flowers, placed on a dais, often in the form of the white six-tusked elephant that Queen Maya, the Buddha's mother, dreamed of at Siddhartha's conception, and then bathed in sweet tea. The sculpture depicts Siddhartha Gautama the moment after he emerged from his mother's womb. He took 7 steps in each of the 4 directions and declared, 'Above the heavens, below the heavens, I alone am the honored one. I shall dispel the suffering of the world.' The bathing ritual reenacts what happened right after that, when the Nagas, great chthonic serpent deities, washed the newborn in warm rain. As the nuns are decorating the flower hall, Master Yodo reminds them that no Buddha exists outside of our own heart. In our ceremonies and devotions, we are honoring this one, the beholder who is born afresh in each moment." And if you've spent any time around a Zen temple, you'll know that often someone will say, well, this bowing to the Buddha, this is bowing to our own Buddha nature. This is not about something outside or separate from us. This is about our own hearts when we bow. Each of us is the only one who can dispel suffering. We can't wait for the Buddha to do it for us. This is our work. We are the hands and eyes and feet of the Buddha right now. I'm adding here, by the way. If you read this, you might go, wait a minute. Amala Wrightson didn't say that. So apologies for that, Amala. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, we are our own protection. We are indeed our own secure abiding. How could it be otherwise? The Buddha's birthday is celebrated during the springtime in the Northern Hemisphere. I grew up in subtropical Auckland, where the differences between the seasons are not pronounced. So when I trained in Western New York, I was unprepared for the effect that spring had on me after the long, hard winters. When spring finally began its slow procession of blooms, crocuses, daffodils, tulips, magnolias, cherry and crabapple blossoms, peonies, I'd feel an acute tenderness mixed with joy, relief, and gratitude. I could now fully appreciate Master Huang Bo's words. Without a whole spell of cold that bites into your bones, how could the plum blossoms regale you with their piercing fragrance? I'll read that again. I feel like it really says something important here. Without a whole spell of cold that bites into your bones, how could the plum blossoms regale you with their piercing fragrance? Huang Bo is also writing here about what happens after the winter of letting go of all our notions about ourselves and the world and the wonderful springtime that follows. I'm remembering now my very, very first retreat, which was in the 80s, and it was a women's retreat in California. And I had never been to California in the springtime. And it was March in California, which is the height of spring there. And it was entirely new to me to go into silence and be in retreat. And it was in the hills of Sonoma County. And the open grassy hills were emerald green, the brightest green you could imagine. And in that retreat, I experienced something I had never known before, which was a kind of freedom. And it was a very specific kind of freedom, which was, this might not sound like much to you, but it was huge to me, that I didn't have to believe everything I thought. And I'd had a lot of pretty dark thoughts up until that point. I was in my early 20s, and I'd really suffered in my teens. And I had this awareness, this awakening around understanding that I didn't have to believe everything I thought. And it was like joy just washed through me. And I walked those extraordinarily beautiful green hills experiencing a joy I had literally never known before in my life. That was the springtime of my life. And my lifetime of Dharma practice began at that moment. I mean, how could you turn away from that once you've tasted that? So I think that's what she's talking about when she says what happens after the winter of letting go of our notions and the wonderful springtime that follows. So I want to drop down a little further into this question of what flowers have to teach us. Because they do have these two qualities, right? They have this quality of joy, of the return of spring, of beauty, and the way beauty can just pierce our hearts. And they have this other quality of their impermanence, of their ephemerality. Teigen and I share many things, but one of the things we share is a deep concern about what's happening in the world these days. And I know we're not alone in that. There are a lot of things happening in this world that are hard to bear. Teigen was telling me that Joanna Macy was here speaking not too long ago, and this is something that Joanna, who's an extraordinary Buddhist eco-philosopher, talks about a lot as well. She calls this time the time of the great turning, where our old ways of being and consuming and being in relation to the world are beginning to fall apart, and it's obvious with climate change and what's happening to our oceans and to the water, and that this is a time where some shift has to happen, absolutely has to happen. But it's also a time where many of us feel grief about the world. And, you know, as a person who's been involved in the conservation of endangered plants for most of my adult life, climate change makes a lot of the work that I've done. I mean, trying to protect one endangered species can take decades of hard work, trying to buy up land where that habitat for that species is, and figure out ways to help that particular unique form in the world continue. Well, with climate change, a lot of that work begins to seem moot because we can't buy up enough land to figure out what every species is going to need as the habitat where they have grown for millions of years changes underneath them. So how to work with this? How to work with this side of the flowering world, right? Which is that there's grief in the world. There's a story in the book from an ancient Chinese woman teacher, Ling Jingbo, and she is encountering another teacher, and they have this exchange, and it ends with her saying, to be a human being is to live in calamity. That's a pretty powerful statement, right? To be a human being is to live in calamity. So this is what brings us to practice, many of us, personal calamity, social calamity, some sense that there's something to understand here, that we need help, we need to sit down and really look at it, face it. To be a human being is to live in calamity. So this is a precarious time in the world, but it's a precarious thing to be a living being. And that's always been true. I mean, Ling's statement, to be a human being, to live in calamity, is to live in calamity, was said more than 1,000 years ago in China. And actually, if you read the history in China, over and over again, they would create these beautiful, relatively stable cultural flowerings. And then all hell would break loose. And there would be civil war, there would be invaders, and everything would fall apart. And then slowly, slowly, they would recreate monasteries and places of learning and art forms. And then another wave would come through and wipe it out again. So this has always been true. This is always the human question. How do we do this? How do we appreciate the flowers, appreciate the beauty and grace that arises in our lives? How do we take care of the world? How do we nurture the gardens in our yards, in our hearts, in our communities, in the world, knowing that also things fall apart? How do we work with both of those? I actually want to read Joanna Macy's contribution to the book in relation to this, because she speaks very directly to this. We were so happy that she was willing to be part of this book, because she is truly one of our living treasures, in her 80s now. Oh my goodness, it looks like I have my place marker here. Nope, I find it. Second. Oh, it's going to be in this section. There it is. This is called Chen's Mountain Flowers. Oh, here it is. So this is probably from very early in the history of Zen in China. Not quite sure, but it could be as early as the 8th century. Chen was a laywoman who traveled far and wide visiting famous masters. After she realized enlightenment, she composed the following verse. Up on the high slopes, I see only old woodcutters. Everyone has the spirit of the knife and the axe. How can they see the mountain flowers reflected in the water, glorious red? Joanna chose this koan. And if you know Joanna, you might have a sense of why she chose this particular one. Laywoman Chen has seen a lot of the world in her journeys from one spiritual master to another. She has kept her eyes open. She's noticed what's going on. Even up on the high slopes where the trees grow sparse and vegetation thins out, she sees what people are up to, busily hacking away at anything that can serve as fuel. The old woodcutters are only doing what's been done for generations, taking from the earth whatever can be used. They've grown so accustomed to sawing and chopping, it's how they define themselves and their purpose for existence. Their tools, knife and axe, shape their perceptions, direct their movements, become, in a sense, who they are. And I think we can all feel how this is one of the habits of the world today, this spirit of the knife and the axe. I love how Chen observes this. I am moved that her quest for enlightenment has not closed her eyes to what is being done in and to the workaday world. It still summons her attention, even after she finally realizes enlightenment. I appreciate this because my attention, too, is so preoccupied with what we collectively are doing to our world. I cannot drive it from my mind. My spiritual practice calls me to come to terms with the destruction we humans are causing. I wouldn't want an enlightenment, that's in quotes, that would keep me from knowing and feeling the ways our actions are unraveling the very web of life. I want to be present to the suffering that comes with the spirit of the knife and the axe, the spirit of bulldozer and chainsaw, of deep sea drilling and mountaintop removal, of factory farms and genetically modified seeds. Joanna Macy, in my feeling for her, is one of the fiercest teachers around. She's this lovely, soft-spoken older woman, and she is absolutely and completely fierce. And actually, there are many old women in this book just like her. And those of us who will one day be old women, I think we should embrace this as a path that an old woman can speak the truth. Joanna Macy speaks the truth. There are different ways of responding to this hacking away. And my customary response is one of outrage and opposition. She is a lifelong activist. I want to make these actions stop. And in order to stop them, I'm ready to harangue those involved, to shame them and show them how wrong they are, and to try to take away their tools and their funding. I don't think to aim for anything more. And indeed, outrage and opposition do save some mountain flowers. How different is Chen's response? Instead of staying riveted on what the woodcutters are doing, her mind turns to what they are missing. The mountain flowers are right there in full view. The blossoms are real and red, glorious to behold. See how the water repeats them in its quivering mirror. Chen returns us to our senses. And that is what she wishes for the woodcutters to see. To see and feel the life around them. Look, right here on the branch of this tree you're chopping are the bright flowers. As she snaps them awake from these habitual behaviors, the world comes into focus. That's the kind of stopping she aims for. That's the kind of stopping where one comes back to oneself, and oneself is the place where real change can occur. So I think this points towards something really, really important for us, just essential, especially for anyone who feels the suffering of the world and really wants to address it. There's something very subtle that she is turning for us here, which is, yes, we need to do that work. The world needs us. It needs us desperately. And if all we see is the spirit of the knife and the axe, then we've been captured by the knife and the axe. We are just as much cut down by the knife and the axe as the trees on the mountainside. So our work is to both see clearly what's happening in the world, to respond to what's happening in the world, but also to see those glorious red flowers, to celebrate the spring when it arrives, to celebrate the people who are blessing the world. People we know in our lives, people in the wider world, to really feed our hearts with what is beautiful in the world, even as we know that everything changes, even as we don't know the future for ourselves and for other beings in the world. We must actually take care and appreciate what's here, right in front of us, right in front of us. The crocuses in the drifts of purple in people's yards, right in the poorest neighborhoods of Chicago, right? Side by side. A story from a Mahayana Sutra that's been very, very important to me personally is a story where one of the arhats, one of the disciples of the Buddha, asks the Buddha a really important question. And he says, why is it that the world is so difficult? Why does the world have all of these places you have to walk up and places you have to walk down, and it's so uneven and there's so much suffering? I just don't understand. Why is the world like this? I think this was really my question. This is what brought me to Dharma practice. So I really appreciated this question. It's a real question. And the Buddha says, let me show you the world I see. And he puts his big toe on the ground. And suddenly, everybody in the assembly, the person who asked the question and everybody else, can see the world that the Buddha sees. And it's a world of jewels, of flowers everywhere, of perfection. That's the Buddha's vision of the world. And it's not that the world we see is more real or less real than the Buddha's vision. It's that they're both true. There is a deep perfection in the world, and there's suffering in the world that we, and in our own hearts, that we must address. But if we lose sight, in whatever way we can feel it, with what the Buddha showed his disciple, the jeweled palace that we live inside, that's busy doing its thing right outside the front door here, then we've lost something really precious. That's always available to us, actually. All you have to do is look up at the sky. That extraordinary blue dome with these clouds that pass across it. I mean, my Lord. And that we have the body and the senses to be able to experience that? Tell me that isn't a miracle. and a completely unexpected, unasked for miracle that we have every moment of every day. And the world's hard. And to be a human being is to live in calamity. That's what our practice is. I want to close with, we'll have some time for discussion, but I want to close with something I wrote that is another reflection on the koan that I wrote about in this book. So I wrote a reflection on an old Chinese story called The Old Woman's Relatives. And but about 2 years before, I already knew this koan was one that had really reached out and grabbed me. And you might have a sense of why when you hear it, now that you know a little bit about me. And there was an opportunity. Sue Moon, my co-editor, was editing an issue of Inquiring Mind, which is the Vipassana journal, that was all about the earth. And she asked me if I, as a conservation botanist and Buddhist, wanted to submit something. And I said, I want to write a commentary on this old koan. So that's what I did for the Vipassana journal, because I love to mix it up in terms of traditions. So I want to share that with you. And if you read in the book, you'll see that this is a completely different reflection than what I wrote in the book. And that's part of what I try to teach and offer about these stories, is that they are mirrors for us. And at one time, if you look at one of these stories and it touches you in one way, if you look at it again 6 months later or a year later, it's going to touch you in another way. So let me offer this as a part of my exploration of how do you hold all these things. Here's the story. Once a monk on pilgrimage met an old woman living alone in a hut. The monk asked, "Do you have any relatives?" She said, "Yes." The monk asked, "Where are they?" She answered, "The mountains, rivers, and the whole earth, the plants and trees, are all my relatives." And this was my response. "I am a Dharma practitioner, a Soto Zen priest, and a conservation biologist. These streams are not separate. My dedication to protecting endangered plants grows from my Dharma practice. My practice deepens through my intimate engagement with ecology and conservation. This ancient Chinese koan of the Zen woman living alone and yet not alone in her hut calls out questions that inform my whole life. It seems that in our Western culture, we are just growing into an understanding of these questions very late. Where are our relatives? Do we recognize them? Do we care for them? Do we allow them to help us? In the overwhelming heat and darkness of a traditional Sioux sweat lodge, participants call out, "All my relations! All my relations!" I think of this as both a prayer and a recognition that we are never genuinely alone. Our relations surround us, the whole earth, all the plants and trees and animals. We are bound together by intimate, inextricable ties of mutual responsibility and support. We plant the flowers in our garden, and they support us the next spring when they come up and share their flowers with us. And here are some stories of my or our relatives. A few years ago, I took a class in genetics at a local college, and one night we watched a film about genetic evolution. That night I learned that we share 92% of our genes with mice, 44% with fruit flies, and, this was the moment when my worldview turned upside down, 26% of our genes with yeasts, those friendly little single-celled organisms that help bread to rise. 26%. Our ancestors differentiated from the ancestors of the modern yeasts about 1 billion years ago. If I could go far enough back in my own family tree, and if I could look deeply enough into my own genetic structure, I would see our shared lineage, our family resemblance. I walked outside after the film. The campus lights were just bright enough that I could see grass and shrubs and the trunks of the trees rising up and disappearing into the dark just past the edge of the sidewalk. As I stood there, I suddenly understood that every living thing around me was a close relation. The Douglas firs, the shrubs of snowberry and the salal, the worms and the sow bugs tunneling in the dirt, the lichens on the trunks of the trees, and even the bacteria munching their way through the dead leaves on the ground. Almost a quarter of my genes were shared with that particular blade of grass, that one right there, just to the right of the edge of the sidewalk crack. Once, a long time ago, my infinitely great-grandmother and that grass blade's infinitely great-grandmother were the same being. This is actually true. This is not a metaphor. This is true. I found myself saying quietly, all my relations, and everything flared into living vividness around me. The people who know me in my dark winter plumage as a Zen priest tell me that they have a hard time imagining my spring and summer life when I take off my priest robes, at least the visible ones, and drive thousands of miles to climb up and down mountain ridges, sweat in the desert heat, clamber through dense, bear-infested brush, and generally occupy myself in ways that very few people would have any desire or inclination to do. I am an itinerant field botanist with a specialty in the conservation of endangered plants. I've done this work for more than 25 years. When I chant the first of the great bodhisattva vows, I vow to save all beings, I am aware that my vow specifically includes what I call the green world. Many of us do bodhisattva work for the human world, but I know how desperately the non-human world needs us too. I have found several plants that are new to science, all of them very, very rare. One of them, a beautiful wild buckwheat with gray leaves and balls of small, bright yellow flowers, is, as I write this, being placed on the endangered species list. It grows on only one ridge top in eastern Washington. The seedlings are no longer surviving the hot summers, and climate change may be part of the problem. These children of mine, millennia older than I, could disappear from the earth before my lifetime is over. With that thought, I feel the heat of the sweat lodge, and I feel the cry, all my relations, rise up in me. I have spent most of my working life with conservation scientists who in their own ways have each taken a vow to protect non-human beings. All conservation scientists live by this koan of the old woman's relatives. Their monastery is the green world, their practice the daily struggle to protect what is disappearing before their eyes. We live sheltered and fed and protected by our relations. We save them and are saved by them. We wake in the monastery of the trees above our roofs, wake to the morning bells of birdsong calling us to wake up, meet our relations with every bite of food, with every breath, with every beat of our heart. We are never alone, just as that old woman in her hut knew completely that she was never alone. She could have said to that nosy monk, "Relations? Why, just look around. Show me one thing that is not a relation." So I think I'll close there, but we have a few minutes for bringing up the Dharma together. Let's not think of this as question and answer. Let's think of it as bringing up the Dharma together.
So So thank you very much. Very eloquent. We have we're not going to have the usual temple cleaning, so we have time for a couple, two or three comments, responses, dharma arisings, and then there'll be some more time informally to do that. So please feel free. Yes, Nicholas.
I loved the last piece that you wrote in that sense of interconnectedness, and you know, I've been lucky enough to have sat with Joanne Macy a couple of times, and just that combination of, you know, this deep grieving that we, you know, need to do for our planet and our disconnection. But on the other side, there is this, you know, all my relations piece of it, and that is just so uplifting and so awe-inspiring. And, you know, I'm trying not to believe my thoughts today. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Other. Dale.
I was reminded of Gary Snyder's famous quote, that he's very much like you, I think. And he says, what should you do about what's wrong and what's happening? He says, don't feel guilty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great.
Hear you.
Don't feel guilty.
Gary Snyder.
Gary Snyder. Who's poet, environmentalist. When asked what to do, what we should do, see the flowers reflected in the water.
You know, one of his lines that was very important to me and actually shaped my becoming a botanist was, there's a beautiful poem he wrote called For the Children. And one of the things he says is, learn the flowers, go light. Mm. And that's been my lifelong practice, to learn the flowers and go light. Yeah, he's a great teacher in this matter.
Kathy.
Welcome, and thank you for that talk. It made me think about, you know, it's like after this winter especially, you know, that there's a frenzy outside right now. I mean, people are excited and enthused and wanting reasons to be outside. And in my condo and on my street, I see, you know, people are like, we're making an effort to other people besides me in my condo trying to figure out how we fill in those gaps where the grass won't grow, and how do we deal with that, or what might. And it's like there's more coming together also in terms of people talking about it. There's a real appreciation for green stuff and flowers right now that I haven't always witnessed. So it affects, you know, it greatly affects, I agree, people's mood and even the sense of coming together.
Dagan, what time did you want to end?
A couple more comments.
Okay. I wanted to end with one poem. So, yes.
Alex.
Thank you for sharing some of the thoughts in this book. That was really very interesting to hear. One of the thoughts I had with Joanna Macy's commentary was this idea of, you know, this thinking that goes along with the way of knife and the axe, and the inability of people that have that as their worldview to be able to appreciate and see the beauty. And I thought it was interesting because Joanna's commentary seemed to be that she had spent much of her life in opposition to that way, the knife and the axe. And I also thought, I see that she almost seemed to be also suggesting that, within that dynamic of one force operating this way and being in opposition to it, that any solution has to come from something actually different from that dynamic and above that dynamic and outside of that dynamic. You know. I think the way to do that, she seemed to be suggesting, was being able to cultivate an understanding of being able to appreciate the beauty of the flowers, which I thought was very well done.
I think it's easier for us to act out of love than out of guilt or out of hatred for things that are happening. That's one of the things that's been very important for me, is to, like, we need to really love the world.
Yeah.
to be able to act from that love. Yeah.
Last one, David.
If I may, having been involved with Black Medicine Lodge, one of the things, and I think that it speaks to all of us in our Dharma, is that when there will be a group meeting, and I think the first thing you say when you stand up and talk is in the name of all my relations. Mm-hmm. That it's not just in the sweat lodge, but it's in every day. And when you go out and you hunt and you take a life, it has been said in the name of all my relations. And oftentimes, Native Americans would carry tobacco with them, bless the spirit of the animal and accept it as a gift. And what I think is not to just what happens, I think, when you talk about the men with the, or people with the knife and the axe, is that they've lost that sense of going to the tree and blessing that tree before. Mm-hmm. We need the tree for sustenance. We need the animals, or we think we need the animals for sustenance. And it's a way of honoring them and mm-hmm. being with them. And that's something that we, mm-hmm. if we carry in our hearts all the time, mm-hmm. we'll be the world will be a better place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Before Florence's closing verse, I just want to share something that Florence told me yesterday from Joanna, which I hadn't heard. For those of us concerned about all the things that are going on in terms of the of climate and Fukushima and all of the perils to our own species, Florence told me yesterday that Joanna says, well, right now what we're doing, we don't know if it is, you know, that something new is coming into being, and what we're doing is midwife work, or maybe it's hospice work, and we don't know and we will never know, and yet it's important.
And they're both sacred. They're both sacred work. Hospice work is sacred. Midwife work is sacred. Yeah.
So would you please close with a verse? And then,
so I wanted to close with a little Dogen. I'm a big Dogen fan. This is, of course, a book translated by Teigen Dan Leighton. And this is a beautiful poem, and I hope you can hear the resonance with the story I told about the Buddha's big toe on the ground. And an Udambara flower is a flower that blooms every 3,000 years on the occasion of a wheel-turning king being born. An Udambara flower naturally opens on an old tree. Early plum blossoms erect a sanctuary, a bright tower in the night. A silvery pearl net hangs over the entire world. The ground becomes pure as lapis lazuli. Thank you.
Thank you very much.